Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket today. I assume all parties have checked in. Before I kind of get into the brief instructions to counsel, we just did this off the record, but let me say on the record, on behalf of my colleagues, we thank everyone at Overland High School for welcoming us here today as part of the Courts in the Community program. So thank you for that. I know that we have a very experienced counsel arguing with us, but let me briefly remind you of the procedures. In our first case, there will be 20 minutes per side, given that we have two separate appellants. It's my understanding that the appellants have split the arguments 10 minutes each. Is that correct? Nodding yes. And I believe you're going to have a yellow light come on when you have 2.5 minutes left in your argument, so for each of you. So we'll do that. And on the appellee side, you'll have the usual yellow light will come on with 5 minutes remaining in your argument. You all are the masters of your own time. Please do know and take seriously that all of us have read all the briefs in this case, and at least one of us has been through the record. So although the time is yours, remember your time is limited, and we would strongly advise you to get right to the issues that you're bringing before us. As you all know, the arguments are recorded and available through the court's website, and we're using our usual recording system, even though we're here at Overland High School. Given that, please do stay close to the microphone so that we make sure we get a good recording for you. If there's any confidential information in your cases, you know, victims' names or anything that you'd prefer to be confidential, remember this is recorded and publicly available, so don't use those names. I'm not sure if we have a toggle switch on the podium anymore, so we're stuck with the podium that we have. Please do, everybody in the room, turn off any pagers, cell phones, and anything else that might make noise and distract any of the attorneys. Last kind of preliminary matter, I do want to say welcome to Senior Judge John Criswell on my left. It's always an honor to have you sitting with us, Judge.
Thank you.
With that, we're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Ian Mitchell. I represent Safeway in the matter. The issues for appeal today that I'm here to discuss are the duty of Martinson to perform under the contract, as well as the duty of Martinson to indemnify Safeway for any injuries that occur that arise out of the connection of any work that they perform at the location of Safeway. The contract in question is created by two sophisticated commercial entities. Within that contract, the parties allocated their risks to determine that if something were to occur, Martinson would be responsible to indemnify Safeway, to hold them harmless, and to provide any funds available for damages suffered by Safeway. If an injury arose or occurred out of the performance of snow or ice removal services performed on the location, or the failure to adequately do so, the defendant in this case, Martinson, was to bear that loss.
Are you relying on Exhibit C for that proposition?
Relying on Exhibit C as well as the indemnification provision located within the snow removal services agreement.
Well, do we have a question, Mr. Mitchell, about what is the contract in this case? I mean, there seems that we have the main body of the contract and Exhibit A, which is referred in it or incorporated by reference. Then there's Exhibit B and Exhibit C. I mean, there are three different indemnification provisions in this case. Which one do we rely on?
The indemnification provision should all be relied on. They can all be harmonized in this matter, as was discussed in Boulder Plaza LLC. Essentially, the first indemnification provision specifically addresses the conduct or negligent conduct done by any of the employees of Martinson, either driving there or leaving the premises or while on the premises. The second indemnification provision, actually, which is located in the Exhibit C, is the same indemnification provision that was provided for in Public Service Company of Colorado, in which the parties determined that anything that occurred arising out of the course and scope of the employment or the course and scope of the services, that Martinson would bear the loss.
But wasn't the title of that independent contractor agreement, and shouldn't that be read to say that The indemnification is only applying as to perhaps workers' compensation issues that would arise with Safeway being held liable for Martinson employees?
Absolutely not, because in this case, the indemnification agreement specifically states within that language that for and in consideration of the privilege of performing certain agreed upon or contracted for services on behalf of Safeway, Inc., Martinson in this case agrees to indemnify Safeway. The only logical and plausible performance that they can be discussing there are snow removal services performances, which is why it's attached as an exhibit to the entire agreement.
So what about the title to it, the independent contract? Don't we have to read something into the title of that?
I don't believe that the title incorporates anything other than Safeway requires all independent contractors to adhere to that agreement. Martinson is an independent contractor. They're identified as such in that portion of the agreement. The instruments still must be construed together. And in this situation, especially under this indemnification provision, Safeway is in the situation in which they have absolved themselves of negligence only if they were solely negligent can they be liable. If we were only talking, or if Safeway or the party's intent was only to discuss workers' compensation insurance, Safeway could never be solely liable in Martinson obtaining workers' compensation insurance.
But do we even get there, Mr. Mitchell? In this case, the trial judge says, and I'm not quite sure why the judge felt the need to address it, but there's a fact question here as to whether Safeway permitted or gave any notice to Martinson before settling its workers' comp claim. It seems to me, and you've told us that we have to harmonize all three indemnification provisions, so we can't read out the first provision that says you have to give them notice and an ability to participate. I didn't see anything in the briefs that indicated that there wasn't a fact question on that.
There remained a question, actually, of disputed facts as to whether Safeway provided proper notice and as to whether Martinson ever responded to any notice that was given in conjunction with the underlying workers' compensation case that was filed by Mr. Arellano. Those, however, remain genuine issues of material fact that still must be presented to the trier of fact in this matter. And the trial court's determination that the issue should be dismissed based on a waiver of based on a condition precedent to the contract essentially eliminated Safeway's opportunity to proceed on its breach of indemnity claim.
Well, you're appealing as well, that, and you seem to be asking us to find as a matter of law that there was an indemnification obligation. That's really what I'm getting to, and I'll tell you frankly, I have trouble understanding your argument about a JNOV and how the Figer case kind of gets you a right to appeal now. But let's assume we bypass that. How can we find as a matter of law that there was an indemnification obligation when you've just told us there's a question of fact as to whether there was notice?
Obviously, if there's a question of fact on whether the first indemnification agreement is applicable, there remain genuine issues of material fact with respect to that portion of the indemnification, that portion of the contract. However, separately and under the indemnification provision that relies specifically on any performance by Martinson for which an injury or claim arises against Safeway, they're responsible to indemnify Safeway. It's clear under the plain language of that portion of the contract.
But don't we have a fact question as well as to which indemnification clause counts? Now, you're assuming Exhibit C is part of the contract, and there was some evidence to that effect. But I think there's an argument on the other side that Exhibit C wasn't part of the contract because it's not referred to in the main body of the services agreement.
Under Colorado law, multiple instruments don't have to refer to each other to be incorporated into the contract. And in fact, Martinson relies on Exhibit A in several respects. Martinson relies on Exhibit B in several respects to make their argument that they had no duty to perform under the contract. It's illogical to determine that the defendant in this case can rely on Exhibit A and can rely on Exhibit B and then say, but Exhibit C that's attached and executed at the exact same time, signed off by the parties, is not part of the contract.
But don't we have a fact question on that point as well, what the parties intended?
In that situation, we may have a fact question, but even if there is a fact question, then that does not permit a motion for summary judgment to be granted. In that case, it should be reversed and remanded to the trial court.
I'm confused about your initial point that you can read these harmoniously. It seems to me that if Exhibit C, your point is that notice was not required as a matter of interpretation of Exhibit C, Wouldn't that trump the notice requirement in the body of the contract?
Not necessarily. Obviously, if Martinson had the opportunity to participate in a civil claim that had been brought based on the conduct, for example, an automobile accident occurring with one of their snow removal trucks on the property, then there are some notice provisions with regards to their negligent actions in that situation. Here, we're talking about the parties absolving Safeway of having to pay costs and damages with respect to anything that occurs out of the performance of their work, whether they're on the property at the time, whether it's conduct, or whether it is simply a result of the performance of their work or arises from the performance of their work. The contract itself and the trial court's determination that there was no duty to perform under the contract is an error as a matter of law. The second clause referred to in Safeway's brief specifically shows a duty on Martinson's part to inspect the property, determine whether additional visits are necessary. Under the facts of this case, Martinson did exactly that. Either on the 19th or on January 20th, the morning of the accident, Martinson reviewed the property, determined that snow and ice removal services were necessary, and began to perform.
And that's something that Mr. Arellano is going to be arguing. That's where your interests are aligned with the individual plaintiff.
Correct. In terms of that situation, we still believe that Martinson had a duty to perform. The issue of whether they had a duty to indemnify obviously is a separate contractual issue. Obviously, this court could determine that the duty to indemnify is there remain questions of fact as to that, could remand that and still determine that Martinson didn't have a duty to perform under the contract. However, I think that would be an error as a matter of law in terms of the fact that Safeway specifically requested, as was its right under the contract, that Martinson show up and appear even if a half inch of snow fell on the ground. There is a 2-inch snow condition precedent related to the contract. Essentially, the contract said if 2 inches of snow falls, you must be out there. But the contract also expressly states the party's intent that, states the party's intent essentially that Safeway could at any time request additional services, and Safeway did so.
Counsel, I'm bothered by this. Is the violation here of the contract by the snow removal company a failure to remove snow, or does it relate to ice?
In this circumstance, there's no real difference between snow and ice in the parking lot when it's slick. Although, in this situation, Mr. Arellano's claimed it was the ice that built up in the parking lot that caused him to fall.
Well, as I read the portion of the contract, it seems to make a distinction between snow removal and ice melt. Do you make that distinction?
I don't make that distinction based on the primary clauses, specifically regarding to their duty to perform. It states that if additional services are necessary, they are to perform them, and Safeway can request them at any time. I see that my time has run out. Thank you,
Ms. Mitchell.
May it please the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, I appreciate the opportunity to be before you this morning. I would like to bring out some...
Counsel, would you just identify yourself for the record?
My name is Alan Schaffner, and I represent Mr. Arellano.
Thank you.
I would like to bring out some factual issues that need to be stressed in the case. Mr. Lundy, who was the general manager and boss of Martinson Snow Removal, when he had his deposition taken, brought with him certain exhibits. And one of the exhibits to his deposition, which is in the record, is exhibit number 1, which talks about what his company did for Safeway on that day. And the first heading of that exhibit 1 states, the following snow and ice control services have been provided under our contract. And then it goes on to state all the things that his company did. On the 19th, they sent out a Mr. Sinclair, and he drove a big truck through the lot and de-iced it in the evening. And then on the 20th, he sent out 4 shovelers early in the morning, sent out again a big tanker truck to de-ice the lot and also plowed the lot.
And they billed $948 for all this.
That's right. They billed $948. There was consideration. They were paid. Then Mr. Lundy said in Exhibit 2 of his deposition, or Exhibit 1 of his deposition, that he relies very heavily on a snow removal report. And the reason he uses that is in case there's ever a question of his billing or what he did, that he would show them the report that would indicate what the snow conditions were that day. And that report indicates that snow conditions were less than 2 inches of snow. But nobody's ever protested that they came out to do the work, and they paid for it. Safeway paid for it, and Martinson expected to be paid. And in his deposition, Mr. Lundy stated, I rely very heavily upon that exhibit, so if anyone ever questions my bill, they will see why I came out to the property. And then, very importantly, Mr. Sinclair, which is Exhibit number 3 of Lundy's deposition, wrote a handwritten statement that stated, I came out to the lot, I snowplowed the lot on 120, I had shovelers out there, 4 of them, I spread ice melt, and all the things that he did pursuant to the contract. Now, where this thing runs afoul is that Martinson charged for all this and always has insisted that they had a duty, but their duty was never breached. The problem for Martinson in the case, and this is why there was a reverse course, Mr. Sinclair had his deposition taken after the motion for summary judgment was filed. And Mr. Sinclair stated in his deposition that, look, I really never came out to the property on 120, that's an error. And so therefore, all of this billing that was submitted should not have been submitted because I wasn't the one who did it. Well, if now the person who was supposed to have been doing the shoveling and snow plowing and de-icing didn't show up, Martinson has a problem because now it's not a situation of we did the work and we did it reasonably, or we didn't have notice. The issue is we didn't do it at all.
We don't have to make that decision, right? I mean, the issue for us, your point, I think, is there are guys out there doing this work, or at least there was evidence that there were people out there doing this work. And now you've got several different theories, and I had a little trouble following all of them. One is modification by conduct. One is waiver by conduct. And then I suppose the third is this just kind of shows by course of performance what the intent of the agreement was.
That's correct.
Okay. So I mean, you don't have to make the decision you just were suggesting. From your standpoint, I think your argument is there was evidence to show they were out there before there were 2 inches of snow, and that at least shows a course of conduct suggesting they thought they had a duty.
That's correct. And they were out there because the second paragraph on page 2 of that agreement states that Martinson will perform snow removal duties as necessary, and as necessary doesn't have a 2-inch requirement of snow. And it has to be that way, because if it's a hazardous condition, you're not going to go out there with a ruler and say, oh, it's not 2 inches, so therefore we're not going to remediate the harm.
Well, one thing that's a little bit odd about this agreement, I think, Mr. Schaffner, I mean, it says, shall make additional visits and perform additional services as necessary. It doesn't say who decides. I mean, what's the basis for deciding? Is it a subjective decision by the contractor? Gee, it looks necessary. Does there have to be some evidence? I think that's sort of Martinson's argument, and I'd like you to respond to their argument, that the only way to read this, the second paragraph, logically, is to read it in conjunction with the first paragraph that says you have to have 2 inches first.
Well, I think they're two separate and distinct paragraphs, and Mr. Lundy, and I can give you the citation in his deposition, he states that he called out the snow removal people to spray the lot the night before because it had snowed out. And that can be found in his deposition. I can read it to the court on page I'll give the court the specific site, but he states that he called out these people the night before to do this because it had snowed out, not because there was 2 inches of snow or there was the requirement of it has to be 2 inches or more. He said, I called everybody out because it had snowed out, and so therefore they knew what they needed to do. I told the people to go out there and hit all the lots, and that's what they did.
I think he even referred to a half inch of snow, didn't he, in that deposition?
In the deposition, he also states that it's a half inch of snow, and that's he'll send the people out under those conditions. So there is not a requirement as far as Martinson is concerned.
I'm a little confused, though, about this as necessary. Does that mean that they have an independent duty of care to determine when it's necessary?
Well, he also states in the deposition that he knows what's expected of him by Safeway. And so that indicates to me that he kind of determines when he needs to come out there and do his business. And Safeway doesn't call him every time there's a snowstorm. Martinson, because he's been a contractor there a long time, independently decides when those services have to be performed as necessary and as reasonable, and he goes out there and does the job.
So that contractual obligation imposed on him a premises liability obligation to act reasonably, independently of any request? That's your theory of the case?
Well, my theory of the case is that he comes out there regardless because he knows what's expected of him, and he did.
But what if he didn't come out? What if it was just unreasonable not to come out? Does he have an independent duty of care under the premises liability statute to determine when he needs to go?
I think that part of the contract is probably vague, and therefore his own course of conduct, though, still makes him liable under the Premises Liability Act because he is performing services at the property, and so therefore is in possession of the property and is doing those things that put him under the Premises Liability Act.
Counsel, I gather that the trial court treated this contract as unambiguous. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but I think so. He only referred to the first paragraph and never addressed the second paragraph.
And is it your view that it's ambiguous?
Well, it's my view that it's not ambiguous. I think it's very broad and that the second paragraph should be read separately and distinct from the first paragraph. However, if it can't be done that way, then it is ambiguous, and then the extrinsic evidence of all their actions allows them to have assumed the duty, waiver, those things that I brought up in my brief.
All right.
I think they are responsible any way you look at it based upon their course of conduct. I mean, whether they're responsible under the contract or not under the contract because they did all of these things that put them under the contract. I have 39 seconds, so I'll thank you for allowing me to address you this morning.
Thank you. You guys will have to fight over the 37 seconds you have for rebuttal. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Barbara Stein with Dewhurst & Dolvin, and I represent Martinson Snow Removal, Inc. And I appreciate being asked to be here today, and I hope I'm able to answer any questions you may have. Listening to the questions you had for the other two gentlemen, I think I'd like to address a couple of those issues up front and then talk about a couple other things that I think are significant. In the testimony given by Mr. Lundy, there is discussion about his conversations with Safeway about their expectation. And I think that the plaintiffs have tried to broaden his testimony beyond what he actually stated. His testimony was actually cited in Safeway's opening brief on page 18. And if you read that, what he says he was told what Safeway expected of him was that if there was a half inch on the sidewalk, he was to come out and shovel. And then he said, and 2 inches to plow the whole lot. And if you look at the contract, this makes sense because the contract talks about a sidewalk and a lot. there's never been any dispute that Mr. Arellano fell in the parking lot. He didn't fall on a sidewalk.
Well, let me ask you, Ms. Stein, the next page, they quote more of his testimony where they're talking about the discussion with, I guess, the Safeway property manager, and he's asked. Now, concerning the paragraph that we're talking about, that's why you make the snow removal and ice melt amount to be when there's only half an inch, because you know that's what Safeway wants. I paraphrased a little. Yes. Why isn't that enough to get us a fact question as to what the intent of the parties was, if nothing else?
Well, I think when you read that with the rest of his testimony, he's likely still discussing the sidewalks, because that's what the contract states. That was his prior testimony during the same deposition. I think that he's just, I think to interpret him to say in one place that he's talking about a 2-inch requirement for the parking lot and then later stating it's a 1/2-inch requirement doesn't really make sense with the deposition as it's even cited here.
But isn't it perfectly consistent with the plaintiff's argument that you read the second paragraph of B separately from the first? The second paragraph doesn't have any 2-inch, 1-inch, 1/2-inch, any other requirement. It doesn't say anything. So that would be perfectly consistent with the position that the second paragraph is to be read separately from the first.
Well, I think the two paragraphs can be read together and make sense.
And what you just said, though, is telling. They can be, but I don't think it's for us to make that decision. The question is whether a reasonable fact finder could find differently from your argument. And you're hearing some skepticism from me because I confess that I'm a little skeptical of your argument. It seems to me that there is a question, or arguably a question of fact here, as to what the parties intended. I hear your argument, and I don't think it's necessarily unreasonable that they read together, but I hear your colleague's argument that they should be read separately. Why doesn't a jury get to decide what was intended?
Well, I think because the initial fact issues that the judge looked at were, was there 2 inches of snow or not? He then interprets the contract. And I think when you interpret the contract, you have to give meaning, read the four corners and try to get to the intent of the parties. And I think the reason you don't get to a fact dispute is that if you accept the interpretation requested by the plaintiffs, you basically completely negate the 2-inch requirement provisions. There would be no reason for them to be there if all this was whenever it snows, whenever it's needed, Martinson has to be there to clear the lot.
Counsel, why isn't it logical? Oh, go ahead.
Would you look at page 10 of your brief, please? You quote what are, you refer to as general requirements. Is that a part of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you look under the first paragraph that you quote, which is snow removal general, then you have snow removal walks, then you have snow removal lots. And if you look at the second paragraph or second section of the snow removal general that you quote, it provides that the contract will commence snow removal as soon as practicable, but in no event later than 2 inches accumulation. Do you see that?
Yes, sir.
And if you look down under snow removal lots, it says contractor will begin snow removal after 2 inches accumulation. Don't you find those inconsistent?
I would agree with you.
If it's inconsistent, is it not possible to rely upon aluende evidence outside the contract to determine which way the parties have construed that?
Well, I think if it rises to the level of an ambiguity, then that does allow the court to consider extrinsic evidence.
And isn't an inconsistency in two contract terms ambiguous, result in an ambiguity?
I guess, it can, but at the same time, there wasn't 2 inches of snow on the day in question. In fact, it's debatable as to whether or not we even reached the 1/2-inch accumulation.
True.
Let me ask you about, and along those lines, about Exhibit A then. You have the two clauses.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not reasonable to read those two clauses as a whole to say there are three conditions in which Martinson has an obligation to remove snow? One, 2 inches. Number two, as necessary. Number three, upon a request from Safeway. Why isn't that a logical read in the contract?
Well, I think because reading them separately in that respect makes, again, that this phrase about the 2-inch requirement completely unnecessary, because in that event, snow removal would be, you know, whenever it snows, any amount of precipitation would trigger the requirement for Martinson to perform its services, because if you're reading each one individually, there's no triggering event for their services other than some form of precipitation.
Well, no, not all precipitation would be necessary to remove snow. I mean, if you just have a, you know, a minimal trace amount, or you have some kind of nothing that would accumulate ice, that may not be necessary. 2 inches is always going to be necessary. Other lesser accumulations may be necessary depending on all the circumstances. And then the third requirement is upon request by Safeway. Why isn't that a very logical contract?
Well, I think the problem lies in the as necessary, and at what point and who decides. As they were just discussing with, I think, Mr. Schaffner, is that who decides what's as necessary. If it's Safeway deciding as necessary, then I think it requires them to make a phone call. Otherwise,
now if that is the third condition, or maybe the second condition, isn't there a fact question about whether a phone call or request was made by Safeway? Isn't there a fact question about that?
Or that there was a standing request?
Yeah, I mean, there was no testimony given that Safeway had made that request on the day in question.
Counsel, why is not the standard necessary to be tested by the reasonable person standard?
That's a good question. I think that it would have to be, the reasonable person would have to be other snow removal companies, because I don't think people who aren't in this business understand when the services would need to be provided.
Without going into the question of what evidence would have to be presented, wouldn't it be a fact question in any case?
If the only provision being relied upon is whether or not the services are necessary, yeah, I think that ends up being a fact question, because I think there reasonable people could differ on what's necessary. You know, and this case, the motion for summary judgment actually started out with an argument that Mr. Arellano didn't know what caused him to fall. He walked out from work. He doesn't remember. At one point he said it was ice. Another point he said it was snow. And even though the judge went to the contract to look at that, there's still an issue of an absence of evidence. And under the Christie Lodge case, that's sufficient alone to have granted the summary judgment motion.
I guess I don't understand your argument. We all know he fell, whether it's snow or ice. You know, there's no question the man fell in a parking lot on either snow or ice. Doesn't that alone, the fact that he didn't remember because he hit his head, how does that get you to summary judgment? Can't a reasonable jury decide based on the fact that he fell?
Well,
and it was snowing?
Well, it wasn't snowing at that
or
point
it had
in time.
Excuse me, you're right.
But he could have just misstepped. I mean, there's a lot of things that could have caused him to fall.
But that's not what the district court relied on. You're going on a different ground than the district court relied on.
Right, and I guess my point is that I think he went to the contract, but I believe that under Christie Lodge, there was sufficient basis for him to grant a summary judgment on an absence of evidence.
But he didn't.
He did not.
You don't think that the proof of a fall and the proof, apparently there was testimony that even the people that were the emergency people who were trying to help him were slipping and sliding. There is testimony to that effect, is there not?
There wasn't actually testimony. There were affidavits submitted by Safeway employees that said they saw this.
Sure.
But I guess if I could finish.
Go ahead.
That leads me to another issue, which is that Safeway is a landowner under the Premises Liability Act. And, you know, I'm about halfway through my time, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the indemnification provision in the contract.
Go ahead.
But Safeway has a non-delegable duty as a landowner to make the premises safe. And I think, you know, some of the testimony that was gathered during discovery didn't end up coming up in the motions, and I don't want to discuss it here because I don't think that's appropriate. But Safeway did have a duty to make the premises safe, without a doubt, and it was non-delegable duty.
But what and I know you want to get to the other argument, but I want to make sure I'm understanding. There's plenty of law that says their duty is non-delegable, but there's also plenty of law. Pearson, for example, says there's not necessarily the exclusive possessor of the property. So the fact that their duty was non-delegable doesn't mean, does it, that Martinson has no duty.
No, I don't think it means Martinson has no duty. I think what it means is they both had a duty.
Okay. So why don't we have a fact question then?
Well, you don't I guess I don't understand.
I don't understand the point that you were making just now, then, based on what you just said, that they both have a duty.
Sounds like you're conceding we should reverse.
No, I don't agree. I think
if you both have a duty, shouldn't we reverse if you both have a duty?
Well, the reason I guess I was raising that issue is because there were two arguments made by Safeway that it applies to. First, they claimed Martinson had exclusive control of the parking lot. And that's why I think it's important to note that Safeway had a non-delegable duty. They weren't exclusive of one another. Whether or not my client did its job is a separate issue. That's what we're here about. But the reality is that they didn't have exclusive control of that parking lot. The other issue is this indemnification provision, because under that Exhibit C, it talks about Safeway's not liable unless it's 100% at fault. And I think if you look at this independent contractor agreement, what I read is in the first paragraph, it talks about workers' compensation benefits. In the second paragraph, it talks about employers' liability insurance. In the third paragraph, it talks about injuries and indemnification when Safeway isn't at fault or is less than 100% at fault, I guess. And it's clear from this that this is a separate agreement dealing with the independent contractor status.
Didn't your client testify, and I think it was in a deposition, that he saw no reason to believe why Exhibit C wasn't part of the total contract? Or it was, you know, paraphrasing, was words to that effect.
Yeah, and I think from his perspective, all of these consist of his agreement with Safeway to do work at that site. But I don't think he's saying that that indemnification provision flows to the rest of the contract.
Why not?
He's a snow removal contractor. He's not an attorney. I mean, we've all debated this for months now. And so
But counsel, I guess my question is, the first phrase of the independent contractor agreement, the Exhibit C, refers to the fact that the other party is to provide services to Safeway. Now, is there any contract other than the snow removal contract by which the client or Martinson was to provide services to Safeway? How does it not refer to this snow removal contract?
Well, I think it's referring to the contract, but it's discussing the independent contractor status. If you read all three paragraphs together, it's clear that it's dealing with the workers' compensation situation, just as Mr. Arellano's relationship with Safeway. If he falls at work, they have to cover it. If Martinson's guy slips and falls while he's clearing snow, this says, the independent contractor agreement says, Martinson, you're paying for that, unless it's our fault 100%.
And the purpose could be that Safeway is exercising control over the Martinson employees such that they would be deemed by a workers' compensation board to be a
right.
Safeway, quote, employee.
Right. I think that this is simply to show they're an independent contractor and they're responsible for insuring their own employees' workers' compensation.
Then in what situation, then, do you visualize the indemnification clause of Exhibit C applying?
If someone from Martinson hurts themselves while they're working at the project.
Safeway would not be liable, or Martinson would indemnify them, even if Workers' Comp Board held Safeway liable for that.
Right. I think that's exactly what it's applying to. It's if someone from Martinson injures themselves while they're working out the site, they can't sue Safeway for damages. They have to be compensated through Martinson.
So along those lines, the district court may have been wrong then in saying it's not part of the contract. It's part of the contract, but just the interpretation is more limited than Safeway is asking for an interpretation in this case.
Well, I think it doesn't apply to Mr. Arellano's fault.
You're saying it applies only to a third party with respect. What would be a third party with respect to Safeway?
I think the independent contractor agreement applies to Martinson's own contractors because they hire subcontractors.
I understand. What I'm saying is that, for example, the employee of Martinson would be a third party with respect to Safeway.
Correct.
And this applies to a claim that person might make against Safeway. That's what you're saying.
yes, limited. Like, for instance, if a customer fell at Safeway, I think that they'd fall under these other provisions that talk about, was Martinson negligent in performing its work? If so, Martinson has to pay for damages for a patron falling at the grocery store.
You're saying that indemnification in C only applies to Martinson's employees?
Employees and contractors that it hires to remove snow. But it wouldn't apply to the patrons. And the fact that there are two other indemnification provisions in the service agreement that clearly set aside, you know, the agreement between the parties of how to handle someone falling and getting hurt, basically. I mean, that's what this would handle. So I believe this contract is clear that the indemnification provisions that would apply to Mr. Arellano are found in the service agreement, and that this provision that was relied upon by Safeway in its motion for summary judgment is basically a workers' comp type provision for Martinson to pay for any of its own employees or contractors who get injured on the job.
Was there any evidence about that presented in the summary judgment record? In other words, what was intended by Exhibit C, the indemnification clause?
Actually, I don't believe there was. It was strictly a here's a contract, judge interpret it type motion.
Right. And so, I mean, it seems to me, and disagree if you do, that it really isn't for us to decide as a legal matter. It's not, I don't even think it's before us, the question as a matter of whether Exhibit C applies as a matter of law. If, and I don't mean to prejudge us, of course, but if we were to reverse, your position is as a fact question on the indemnification provision.
Yeah, and for a couple of reasons, because the other issue was whether or not Martinson had proper notice.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that was exactly where we were headed with that, is that I don't think that the judge was in error in saying Exhibit C's indemnification provision didn't apply. But with respect to that, he denied it because there was a fact dispute.
So do you agree that this issue is really properly before us, this JNOV issue? I've not seen a case, as Judge Gabriel, I think, mentioned a question, that you can file a judgment notwithstanding a verdict motion when there is no verdict.
It likely isn't properly before this court, but the parties obviously spent a lot of time briefing it. And
so you'd like us to decide it even?
Let me ask you, because I think, and I was troubled by it procedurally, this issue. I am, as I said to one of your colleagues, I'm very skeptical that this JNOV procedure was proper in this context. But it does seem to me the court did find, district court found as a matter of law, that Exhibit C didn't apply. And it seems to me on all the cases that say when one party gets summary judgment, the other party who was arguing in response can raise the arguments they've made. I think it's properly presented to us because the court really did adjudicate that issue, at least as a matter of law. Do you disagree?
Well, it dealt with it all in one order,
right?
And that order was, I guess, final after, I can't remember if he finalized it or if it was based on time. I can't recall. I'm sorry. But it was all dealt with in the same order.
Although you may still have an obligation to indemnify, depending on the fact question. Is that right?
Based upon that other provision.
Right.
Correct. Yes, that wasn't really in dispute.
So there's no final decision about whether you have to indemnify Safeway or not.
Correct. That hasn't been dealt with completely because of the fact dispute. And I'm running out of time. I want to thank you for your time, and I ask that you affirm the judgment of the lower court.
Thank you, Ms. Stein. Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Schaffner, you've got 37 seconds if you're going to use them.
Just to be very brief, Your Honor, the issues here as to whether they had a duty to perform, whether the indemnification provisions were triggered, all beg the question as to why Martinson was on the property performing services. If they had no duty, they shouldn't have been there. Since they were there, the indemnification provisions should apply in this matter. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Schaffner, Ms. Stein, we thank all of you for your oral arguments and your briefs today. You got 11 seconds. I'm sorry, Mr. Schaffner.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to direct the court to page 119 of Lundy's deposition, where he's asked why he went out there, and he said, I said, what prompted you to call them? And he said, because it snowed out. Question, how did you tell Swink to do it on January 20th? I said, go hit all of your properties with spray, and they know exactly what is done and what is expected. They've done them 100 times before, so they know exactly what to do, which really goes to the as necessary clause. Martinson knows what's expected of him. He goes out there independently and does his thing. He doesn't have to wait for Safeway to call him up to do
Thank
it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for interrupting you as you're getting up. I was a little surprised to see you get up, but you're welcome to. Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Schaffner, Ms. Stein, we thank you all for your oral arguments and your briefs. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. At this time, we're going to take a brief recess, and I know the students will have a chance to question all of the council. And so with that, we'll be in recess briefly, and the bailiff may summon us.